pages we turn, and we're thankful for what we learn. We rightly divide this truth it will show, and we'll know which way to go.
Good afternoon, this is Pastor Craig, and welcome to Study His Word. And I have here in the studio, Scott. We had originally scheduled a possible person to have here in the studio, and we just couldn't work the logistics of it out. So we'll try and get a phone interview lined up here in the near future so we can do that. So I asked Scott to stick around, and he's been on the road a lot lately. I've been on the road a lot the last 3-4 weeks, and so we're just going to take some time to just kind of mellow out and chill out and just kind of chit-chat.
Reflect.
There we go. Reflect on everything.
Well, I
we were a little too chilled out there at the beginning of the show.
Well, I demonstrate my lack of skills in managing everything here. Oh, my goodness. So, Scott, so we talked a lot about Philadelphia and talked a little bit about New York. What was the, you know, and maybe it was the Hall of Fame presentation, I don't know, but what was New York, Philadelphia, the most impressive thing that you saw, or you really enjoyed the fact that of taking something in that you wouldn't otherwise?
Oh, taking it in. I mean, obviously, when you're doing a presentation and being part of the show, that's probably going to be it. But I have to say, and again, I haven't watched wrestling in well over 20 years, and I did not know the majority of the people who were there. But just the production of WrestleMania sitting in that luxury box, I could not believe that they sold out the football field. Over 70,000 fans over two nights. The combined attendance in that city was 145,000 people over two nights, and that people came from 50 states, 68 countries, and seven Canadian provinces. And the show they put on, I mean, the fireworks, the lighting, the spotlights. I mean, you couldn't count the spotlights. There were probably 200 to 300 spotlights going on in that arena. Their lighting apparatuses. It was just unbelievable.
The amount of setup time must have been unbelievable.
Well, I think that's why they have hundreds of employees there. I mean, it just is a production.
Now, do you know what the ticket price was for somebody who wanted to attend?
Oh, depending on where you sat, but I mean, it was thousands for both nights.
That's incredible.
It's it's their event, WrestleMania. Yeah. 40 years.
That's amazing.
It is. It is. It is.
So we were kind of talking before last hour. I'd asked you, you know, jitters or butterflies, and you experienced none of that.
No,
but you mentioned when we were talking on the break, and you mentioned that in general, when you're speaking before a crowd, whether it's 10 people, 1,000 people, you had all those things with Mary Ellen at the schools. You don't experience that nervousness or that. Jitters.
No, but you know, I should delve deeper into this, because I do believe people who don't have nervousness and who are not excited give bad speeches, because I think you come up with no energy. Right. And I think that's bad. Now, in my case, excitement I have. Mm-hmm. I am ready to go. I mean, I want to get out there to that microphone. I want to start. I want to see what's going to happen. Now, part of that is probably why I don't write speeches, because I know when I walk up to that microphone, is it going to be there or is it not going to be there? How's it going to go? You don't know, because I'm not looking at a teleprompter, and I don't have papers with me. I can't look down at them and grab anything. So that probably amps up my excitement level to a certain degree, which hopefully makes it a good speech.
Yeah. Now, in general, when you're doing a speech at whatever the forum is, you don't have a prepared speech.
No. No, because I just don't think it's good. And the times that I've ever had to do that, I always felt like there were more things I wanted to say. I wanted to look at the audience. I didn't want to look down at the notes. And I don't know. Everybody's got their own technique. I just don't like to write a speech, because I want it I want whoever there to experience it as I'm experiencing it. And whatever comes through my mind in that moment, I want to be able to say without any, I got to go here next.
You know, it's interesting because obviously I've spoken before a lot of crowds, obviously not the size of the crowds that you have, but, you know, I've pastored a couple churches. So, you know, every Sunday I was getting up. And it's interesting because I would always feel a little bit of, you know, like nervousness in the stomach and butterflies that last 3 or 4 minutes before I went up there. But once I walked up there, I mean, that feeling was gone. And I was just totally, you know, comfortable, not nervous. But I have always not been able to work from a script or even to work from an outline. When I get up there, I mean, I just have to talk naturally and make the eye contact. So the most I will take up there with me in the pulpit is a list of the scripture references that I might use so that I don't have to memorize them. You know, you'll be able to look down and say, you know, Matthew, whatever. But I can't work off. Early on, I tried like an outline, and I found myself concentrating more on my outline than what I was saying. So it's like once you get up there, I mean, you know what you want to say. You know, you might not have, you know, a prepared speech, but you know the points that you want to cover, the things you want to say.
Well, and I also think, in my case, the only time I ever bring notes, period, to a speech or an interview are quotes, because I don't want to misquote somebody,
right.
And all are numbers, because I don't want to get the number wrong. And other than that, that's about it.
So did you have any story you wish to tell, any harrowing experience on your flights?
Well,
here it comes.
Yeah, the flight there was very, the flight home was fine, but the flight there, I got to the airport and found out almost immediately that there was a 2-hour delay because of lack of staff in Philadelphia to get the plane ready to come back. So then the 2-hour delay happens. Then I find out there's another hour delay for maintenance issues, and I went up to the lady and I asked her what the maintenance issues were, and she said, well, it's confidential. And I said, now, maintenance issues like a wheel came off the dinner tray or like a wing fell off the plane. What kind of maintenance? Confidential. Those people do not have a sense of humor. So 3 hours late, we get on the plane, and I've got people on each side of me at this point. Now, the one, and we're also on the Screaming Baby Express, by the way, too. There are just babies screaming all over this airport. I don't know if it's the delay, but it's the Screaming Baby Express we're riding on heading to Philadelphia. Thank goodness it's only an hour flight. Now, the one lady on one side, all she could talk about was she's not going to hit her connecting flight to go to Lisbon because we just had this 3-hour delay to go to Philadelphia. So she's just panicked, and she keeps bothering the flight attendant. And it's just on and on and on and on and on. Okay, enough of that. So I turned to the other lady who seemed a little, she seemed like a seasoned traveler. And she first thing she says to me, which is, boy, I'm hungry. And I thought, well, you've come to the right place. This is where we all come to eat. You've come to the right spot. You're going to get those cookies, and boy, that's going to be delicious. So we continue the conversation a little bit, and she said, oh, I just love flying. And I said, oh, that's very nice. Okay. And then a little bit of time passes, and we weren't really talking because this lady was going on about Lisbon incessantly. So the light goes off where you're allowed to take off your seatbelt. And this lady starts to, like, crouch up in her seat next to me. And I think, well, where is she? Maybe bathroom, you know, something like that, maybe. But she's doing it in a crouch way, not like she's going to leave her seat. And she crouches up, and I see her go, and she hits the flight attendant button, and she gets her face about an inch away from the air nozzle. And she says, I'd like a hamburger and some French fries. I think she thought she was at McDonald's. And I leaned into her and I said, that's an air nozzle. And she said, oh. And she sat down, and that was the end of that conversation.
Wow.
And she seemed like a seasoned traveler. I don't know what happened. That was my flight.
Oh, man. You should have said, they only have steak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess it kind of looked like McDonald's.
So now on your other flight, did you have people around you? Or
she slept.
She slept.
She slept. She was worn out.
All right. So let me ask you this. If she had been awake, are you the type of traveler that I'll get in conversation if the other people do, but I'm not going to start it? Or are you, I'm going to start a conversation and find out about these people around me?
I want to start a conversation, but if somebody I can tell is tired like that, I don't want to encroach upon them. And also, I think also, like the first flight, those people wanted to talk. It was a night flight. And but I, you know, there was a certain point where we had nothing to say after that whole McDonald's incident. And I didn't know what to say to these people who were so worried about getting to Lisbon.
Yeah.
So it just was that.
Was this your first night flight, or have you flown at night before?
You know, I don't think I have flown at night. But it wasn't any different, really.
Okay. You weren't in the window seat.
No, but I could see out the window. Okay. Yeah, because it was like three or four seat plane.
Okay.
So it wasn't bad.
Okay.
Yeah, it was good.
All right.
I did look out the window, though, as we were circling the airport, seeing all the lights in Philadelphia. I thought that was neat.
Yeah.
Landing at night.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Landing at night.
So that was good.
Right. So you didn't get mugged in Central Park when you went to Tavern on the Green.
No, but what a place that is.
I was listening to your description on the radio the other morning, and
you know, I had never been there, and boy, I'll tell you, if I was going back to New York, that would be the place. That's the one.
How much did you know about it? Because I've heard of Tavern on the Green, but I really didn't know that it was, you know, an exclusive restaurant in Central Park.
Dress code and all that. No, I knew it was one of New York's iconic spots, and I knew it had been talked about in movies and television shows, and you hear things about it, but that's about it. But boy, it is just the most majestic place, because you're in this gigantic city, biggest city on earth, Gotham City, they call it. And you enter the park. You literally enter the park, and here's this restaurant. It looks like a restaurant in any park. But yet you go in there, and you know you are in the biggest city in the world, and the whole place is glass. It's all windows, and you see the park, you see all this beautiful greenery, but yet you see the skyscrapers from behind the greenery, and it's just something. Little candlelights on all the tables, and it's an atmosphere.
Well, I remember, you know, I was well into my adult years before I even realized that in downtown New York, there was this park that was huge. I mean, it's bigger than most city parks, and it's in the downtown area.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an unbelievable area to go to, and I would recommend that anybody go to Tavern on the Green, and the displays that they put on with the food. I mean, I had the ravioli, which is something I don't normally get, but I mean, it is just garnished with all kinds of greenery, and it looks like ravioli you've never seen and tastes delicious.
But they're sandwiches are more than $5.
Yeah, they're sandwich. It's not McDonald's. Yeah, it's going to cost you a bit to eat there, but you pay for it.
Worth it one time just for
the
experience.
Yes, yes, yes. You have to go one time for the experience. Now, Matt and Carrington got the chicken, and they were eating it with their fingers. And I, you know, I felt, you know, I just.
You don't say, you don't have
I didn't
to say
anything.
You don't
I
have
just.
To say any more than
well,
that.
And also we got the appetizer was bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately take the bread and start to break it and put the butter on top with my spoon and fork. And they cut it like a hot dog bun and put butter down the center. And they thought it was so funny how I was eating the bread, but by the end, they were breaking the bread, too. So there you go.
Did either one of them, when they sat down, did they say, what are these other two forks for?
It was that. And I thought, to a certain degree, that Carrington might have been a little more cultured than that. But I don't know. When in Rome.
Now, was it a very relaxed, leisurely? I mean, were you there? You
could relax.
They didn't rush you?
No. There, a matter of fact, at one point, the guy even came out and said, you know, we're getting ready to close. We've got extra dessert back there. We'll discount it for you. And they were very, very nice people. No rush at all.
Did you happen to go to the 9/11 Ground Zero?
We didn't go down there, no. We did go to Soho, though. We rode the subway down to Soho. And
because Carrington
the cookies, yeah. Yeah. She had this cookie shop she was desperate to go to.
And she shared her cookies with everybody.
No, she did not. But we did go down there, and it was you know, it's the lower part of Manhattan. It's different than the Broadway section of Manhattan. It's just a different midtown, I guess is what you would call it.
Okay.
It's different than midtown. It's a different area.
Now, did you, when you went there, did like she beeline to the cookie store?
She knew where it was.
Okay, so you didn't really take in the Soho experience. You kind of were on a mission there.
We walked around a little bit, but the problem was by that point everything was starting to close in that area.
Okay.
So, which is also different than midtown, you know, it's a neighborhood, it's Saturday, so that was part of it, I think, of why there really wasn't a whole lot going on down there. And also there were things like going to the Top of the Rock and Tavern on the Green that we wanted to do, and the subway ride is not immediate.
Okay.
To get back to where we were.
So you did take the subway ride.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see anything in the subway stations or in the subway that you're like, I'll stay over here?
You know, honestly, I did. Clearly, it's a very old form of transportation. I mean, that's what you first notice about the whole thing. But the only thing that was odd about the subway was there was a point when we got on where we knew we had to get on because we had to get back to these areas or they were going to close. And when we got in, you know, it's been a long time since I've been that close to two people, because Matt just made it in the door, so I can feel his breath on the back of my neck, and Carrington, her nose is right against my nose, and, you know, that's a hard time to have conversation.
Yeah.
During that little stint.
Yeah, I guess if you were living in New York, it would still take a while to get used to that.
I think it would. But, you know, at least we all got on.
Yeah.
Because you kind of have to push your way in and push your way out.
Yeah. Interesting.
But I think that public form of transportation is very good.
Yeah.
I think more cities should have that.
Well, as a kid, I used to go up to Toronto all the time because my mom was from Canada and from Toronto, and her parents were still up there. So we would go up there about once a year. And, you know, when I was a kid, like 10, 11, 12 years old, and this was back in 1970, it was very safe. So it was no big deal for my parents to give me a couple quarters, and I would ride the subways all day long. I mean, I didn't want to spend all day with all these old people sitting around. And what I would do in Toronto is it was on an east-west, and I would take it all the way down to the end. Then I would ride it all the way to the other end, and then I'd go back to the middle, and then I'd ride the north all the way north and the south. And, you know, I mean, I would be gone for hours and just ride the subway. And it was really fascinating. It was really, like you said, a neat form of transportation that works in that kind of a setting.
Yeah, it's a great way in a city like New York, where obviously it'd be hard to have a car or even sometimes a bicycle with the weather the way it is, to have that mode of transportation to get from one area to another that is not that expensive, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. Now, did you see a lot of policemen on horses?
No, not really. There was something going on that day, and I really don't know what it was, because there were a lot of street vendors set up and a lot of things going on in Central Park, but I really don't know what it was a celebration of. The Plaza Hotel was great, though. I loved going in the Plaza Hotel because, you know, you don't have to have a room there to understand that's the place where movies have been filmed. That's the place where the Beatles, Frank Sinatra, that's where celebrities stay when they go to New York. It's the Plaza. And to go in there, I mean, it's marble. The whole place is marble. The walls are marble. The floor is marble. The ceiling's marble. It's something.
How much is a room?
You know, I don't know, but I'm guessing not cheap. Not cheap.
It's going to be more than
100. It's going to be a little pricey.
A little more than 100.
little more than 100 to stay at the Plaza. But, you know, it's one of those places where it has a huge lobby. People come in and they love to have their – there was a tea going on that particular day, and people just like that.
Yeah. Now, was it – this tea that was going on, was it mixed men, women?
Whole thing. Yeah. It's not a women's event, really, or at least from what I could see. Right. No, a lot. But it was very formal. You know, sports coats and ties and dresses. And, you know, I kind of like that in a way, to be honest with you. I believe we've become very, very casual in life. And one thing, when we went to the Hall of Fame, clearly it was black tie on my behalf, and it was black tie on Mrs. Ali's behalf. But there's a picture, because Carrington and Matt both dressed up to some degree for that particular event as well. And, you know, everybody loves the pictures. Because, again, we don't dress up anymore like that.
We don't.
You don't do it. And I think you should. You don't have to do it every day, but why not?
I agree. We've lost that formal aspect of it. Because I remember when I was a kid growing up, we always dressed up to go to a restaurant. And, I mean, it wasn't just because it was a top-of-the-line restaurant, because we went to all kinds of restaurants. But just when we went out to a restaurant, we dressed up for it. When we went to church, we dressed up for it. People don't dress up for church anymore. People don't dress up for restaurants anymore. I mean, you know, you'll have a guy in a T-shirt and shorts at, even though it's a Bob Evans, it's still, we've lost all that.
Yeah, and I think we've become not only casual in our dress, but we've become casual in our attitude.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Yes, it is.
And I don't know how you fix that problem on the whole, because I don't think people know how to act in those situations where it's very formal.
Right. Yeah, because they've never been exposed to it.
Right, and then they get defensive because they feel you're looking down on them or you're an uppity person, when that's not it at all. There are just situations in life that call for formal and situations that call for casual. It's not a status thing. It's just different times of the day. I mean, would you wear your jeans in the swimming pool? It's the same type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, we've come to the point where we wear our pajama pants to Walmart.
Right. And again, people will say, well, why not? Well, if you want to, I guess you do. But it's
the fact you're going out in public.
Yes. There used to be some pride taken in how you looked when you went out in public. But you know what? We don't care anymore. And you know what? But we don't care in general. And that's an interesting thing. The more torn up, the more beat up, the more whatever, the better. I mean, I see people in pictures now. They'll take pictures with the chew in their mouth, in their lip. I mean, and I think to myself, didn't you know you couldn't spit that out for 10 minutes? I mean, to me, that's a reflection of something.
Well, you look at pictures from the first half of the last century, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, and I find it interesting, you know, iron workers building skyscrapers, and they're wearing long pants, dress shirt, and a vest. I mean, they're like dressed up for physical labor.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know what it is now that we just don't care. Well, I don't know if it was the generation before that did not teach their kids to do that. I don't know where it started.
I think I honestly think it was my generation that didn't teach their kids. Because I was raised, you know, about, you know, you got dressed up for certain things. You wear certain clothes just to go out in public. You behaved in a certain way in a restaurant. And I really think it was my generation that did not carry that on with their kids.
Now, why was that?
I don't know. I really don't know.
And we lost something.
Yeah, we've lost something. Well, you know, I kind of do know. I think what it was the whole hippie generation of the 60s and 70s, the question authority, the I'm going to do whatever, not listen to the man. That's when we first started calling cops pigs. We lost respect. And it carried over in the lack of respect, because it's my generation that took their kids to daycare. We started seeing a lot of moms in the workforce, so the moms aren't raising the kids, the daycare is. And when we took our kids to daycare, they were calling, at 5 years old or 3 years old, they were calling their daycare teachers by their first name. You know, it was Miss Jennifer, or it was Miss Kathy. Yeah, they put the Miss in front of it, but they were on a first name basis with adults. I was raised, you never called an adult, no matter who the adult was, by their first name. It was always, you know, Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so. Our teachers were Mrs. and Miss. But when you have kids on a first name basis with adults, that's, again, a further reduction in that respect.
Do you think, though, we have drive anymore to accomplish things? That it's just everything's okay. Whatever path you choose is okay.
I really don't think we have that drive. I mean, you look at the World War II generation and what those men did. I don't think we have near as many 20-year-olds today that could do what that generation did. And I don't think there's a desire to excel at whatever you're doing.
Well, people also really, and there's nothing wrong with failing. I'm not saying that at all. But people don't own their failures.
Right.
You know, it's almost as if I call it a failure, then I'm a failure. Well, no. But part of the experience of life is having failures, but knowing that they're failures and coming back from those failures.
Right.
That's what is the mark to me of a really solid person. But people who, that's not a failure, because if I say it's a failure, then I'm a failure. Well, I don't know that that's right.
It's not. Yeah, I mean, I agree. If you fail at something, you tried something.
Yeah.
You attempted to do something. That in and of itself is not a failure. And a lot of it is that attitude of how you look at it, whether your efforts ended up in failure or whether you view yourself as a failure. And if you view yourself as a failure, then you're going to be a failure.
Yeah, and I don't know, and I think that's what it is. I think the people who deny that they failed at something really do feel like failures, and that's why it takes them so long to come out of that. And in the end, I don't know. I just look at society now, and I see so many people chasing money, so many people denying their failures. All people want to do is get to their vacations and have 2 weeks of happiness and 50 weeks of, I went to work and I came home. I mean, what a way to live. I mean, honest to goodness, I have no idea how you do that.
I know what you mean, because I can think of a couple people that they work 50 weeks a year, and it's all geared toward that 2 week cruise that they're going to take. And every year they take the 2 week cruise.
Yeah.
And even that's hard for me to understand, because my experience has been, we took a 2 week vacation every year, and every year we went somewhere different. You know, I've been in 38 of the 50 states. I appreciate the fact that my parents did that, but we always went somewhere different, saw different things. You know, we had that variety there, I don't know, sense of adventure or whatever.
Right. And I think that, you only get one life, as far as I know, and I would think you'd want to fit everything in that's possible and achieve everything that you wanted to achieve possible in that particular amount of time, and that you would choose something based on money or 2 weeks of leisure out of 52 weeks a year is very peculiar to me. I just don't know. I look at the world and I think maybe that's where we have went wrong. We always said don't be driven by the dollar, but yes, you've got to have money to live. I get it, and that's the truth. But it used to be, when you had a child, you'd say you could grow up to be president. Well, I don't know if we have that philosophy anymore.
No, I don't think we do.
No. Grow up and find something that pays well.
Right.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah. And I can tell you unequivocally that, yes, we only have one life.
Only one life.
We don't get a second life.
One life. No second life. Chance to do it again?
No chance to do it again.
Oh, darn.
You're not coming back as a caterpillar.
Oh, well, I never thought that was a good idea anyway. reincarnation's always an odd thing to me. I don't understand that.
I have no idea. I don't understand it either.
That would be frightening to me.
If you knew that you were going to come back, who'd want to?
Right. Why, as a caterpillar?
Right.
Or a bird?
Right.
Or some, why?
Why?
Why would you want to do and know it?
Right.
I was a person in the last life. Now I get to be a bird. Wow, this is a tick up.
Boy, what's it going to be next time?
Yeah, I don't understand that. But it's a weird, weird, weird world we live in.
Yep.
Yeah. But I don't know. The trip was fun. But boy, I tell you, I don't know how they do that all the time, because it is a very tight schedule.
Yeah. And there's not, I mean, not a lot of room for error.
No. I mean, no. You know, no. You really got to be on it.
I mean, the guy, whatever you're doing, you got to do what you're expected to do.
You got to deliver.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, too, because that's, I mean, you feel that pressure to some degree. That you've got to deliver what they want. I mean, you want to make the crowd happy. I mean, that's why you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to just leave them on the ground.
Right. Hey, guys. Hi. Thanks. For, yeah. Hey. Yeah, this is my friend, and he's going into the Hall of Fame. And,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I say. It's funny to me when people think that just anybody could have been chosen to do it. Right. Yeah, like Fred down the street, we're just going to put him up there. It wouldn't have happened like that. They do vet you and... I think they're fairly confident that you can pull it off.
Now, you said that you were the only person that didn't have a prepared speech that was on the teleprompter. I'm guessing that even before that you even got – I mean, this would be weeks before they wanted to know your speech and they wanted to have a copy of your speech. And is that how that worked?
Well, you know, honestly, a producer called me. I don't remember how much ahead of time it was. Maybe 2 weeks. But we had a conversation on the phone, and there was that, which I assume everybody got this conversation. I can write you something. If you want it on the teleprompter, we can do that. If you want to carry out notes, you can do that. However you want to do it. What's the time frame? That sort of thing. But my conversation with that person was, I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm just going to wing it. And is there a time frame? And they said no. So that's pretty much what it was. And after that, nobody really ever came back and asked anything.
Okay. And so you weren't given like 2 minutes
nope.
or anything like that?
It was nope.
just whatever?
Nope. They said, just go out there and do what you do. And that was, I think that was good. Because I knew time-wise was really the only thing I did think about. Because I knew it's about Thunderbolt. And I knew they want to hear from him, not the inductor. And I didn't want my speech to run longer than his. And I knew that he wasn't running off of a teleprompter. So I thought his speech will probably be between 5 and 10 minutes. So I don't want to go longer than 5. Mm-hmm. So that was the only thing in my mind that I did know. And I almost got caught in that because I didn't expect applause breaks or a chant to break out of Thunderbolt. So I'm doing the speech and then, you know, when 21,000 people start applauding, you really can't continue to talk because it's going to sound terrible.
Right. And the people aren't going to be able to hear you.
No. And I remember when I read the Muhammad Ali quote, they clapped. And I thought, oh, okay, we're going to have to stop here for a second. And then I think when I called Thunderbolt the Jackie Robinson of professional wrestling, they applauded. And then I remember I told a story about a sheriff in Abilene and some things that Thunderbolt went through, and they started to chant. And I was ready to go home at that point. I was ready to say, and now here's Thunderbolt. That's pretty much all I had left at that point.
Yeah.
And there's a Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt. And you hear it from the arena. And it's like, oh, okay, we'll stop again. Comma.
Now, was the Mouth of the South one of the people that was inducted? Not
inducted, but he was there. He's okay. Been inducted before.
Oh, so he's already in
yes,
the Hall of
yes,
Fame.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. Okay. Interesting man.
You know, it's funny because now I don't know what he looked like in person, but from the pictures, I thought, wow, I thought he would have looked older than that.
He looks pretty good. Looks pretty good in person. Yeah, I mean, it's not much different. Mm. Yeah, he was an interesting guy. I liked that Jimmy. Jimmy was a little manic, but he was okay.
But that's just Jimmy.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't putting on a persona.
No. No, this is up in the box. I mean, he's not in front of a camera doing that. Interesting man. I can see why he's lasted so long. You know, he's very inviting. Anybody who wanted a picture, anybody who wanted to talk, he was just that guy.
Yeah. Were there many wrestlers there that were hard to get close to, or was everybody pretty much? If you went up to one of the wrestlers that happened to be there, they were spending time with people?
You know, I think probably because we were on the talent side of it, that they didn't see it as fans coming up to them. So it was we were kind of all in it together.
Okay.
And I think that's pretty much what the thought was.
Right.
Because I think once you were in the luxury box and you were riding over on the same cars that they were...
You're part of the in-crowd.
You're part of the in-crowd. So it wasn't somebody coming up asking for an autograph.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it was just a different vibe going on there.
So nobody came up and asked you for an autograph?
Not that I remember. No, I don't think that happened. But I'll tell you a weird experience, and this is maybe being on national television. You know, you go out and you do it, and you think, okay. And then you get in the car, and you go back to the... hotel, and you know it's late when by the time we're done that night, so we're getting back in the car, and that's the first time I had a chance to pull out the phone. So I pull out the phone in the car, and people were sending me screenshots of myself on their televisions at home. So what a unique experience. So that's the first way I saw how it looked, was through people sending me screenshots of their television.
Now have you actually seen that broadcast
last night?
Okay.
Last night was the first time I'd seen it because Thunderbolt wanted to watch it. Okay. He hadn't seen it either. So I watched it last night. It was okay. It was okay. I was okay with it.
Okay.
Yeah. I normally don't like to watch stuff back, but it was okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. You don't like to watch yourself.
I don't think anybody does.
They don't. I don't.
No. I think you think you make moves and look a different way than how you do, and I think it inhibits you in a way. Because I think if you look at yourself too much, then you stop doing things that you maybe would do, that nobody is paying attention to at all. You're the only one paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Do you ever notice when you watch something, you don't notice something somebody else is doing, but you think you're doing something strange or standing in a certain strange way?
Yes.
There you go.
You know, I literally have hundreds of recordings of myself, you know, giving messages and stuff like that. I do not like listening to them. I won't listen to them unless I have to, because I just don't like listening to them.
Yeah.
Something about listening to yourself. Well, I know for me, it's I'm hypercritical. You know, I'll hear a little stutter in there. I'll you know, hear something and it's like, man, I could have said that differently or something like that. So that's why I just don't like to listen to.
No, and it's just very strange to watch yourself, because when you get comfortable doing something on video, I think you are comfortable. And then when you look at it, you say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. When really, nobody cares. Nobody's looking at anything you're doing.
Right.
You're much more aware of it than anybody else is.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And everybody, I don't know. It's a weird thing. It's a weird thing to watch yourself on video. But I will say, different than maybe looking at a home movie or something like that, to look at a production where you're well-lit and well-mic'd and all that, you know, that changes things to a certain degree. I mean, you feel you look, it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
I can let that live on.
So now, when it was happening live, did from what you could see and hear, did everything go spotless, or were there a little glitch here, a little glitch there that we might not have seen at home, but like it kind of stood out to you?
Well, there were discussions backstage about, you know, certain things, but I don't think there was anything huge that was going on problematic. I think it was little, you know, should this person enter here or there, or, you know, for time's sake, should we put the video here while they're walking to the ring? Little stuff like that. But nothing, no, there wasn't any big breakdown. I mean, for the most part, they're just trying to make that show go. They don't want any walls for the people at home.
And they've certainly done things enough times that it really should go spotless.
Yeah, and I think they have the crew to make that happen, and they know what works and they know what doesn't work, and I think that that's a very important thing. It's this whole idea too, and I should mention this about wrestling being predetermined. Well, yes, it is. I mean, there's no, they're not denying that at this particular point. But I do not understand how that lowers the enjoyment level for anybody, because the fan doesn't know who, and most people in the back don't know who's going to win. That's shared between a very small group of people.
Right.
So I've never understood why that is a diminishment, because that's what they use to diminish that particular industry.
Right.
I don't understand that. Do you have any idea?
No, I don't, because, you know, that's a very good point that, okay, so it is predetermined, but nobody knows.
I didn't know.
Me watching as the fan, I don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Well, that's why when I got involved here on a local level, when they asked me to be the broadcaster for the wrestling, that was more fun than broadcasting any other sport, because you don't know what's coming, and there's never a blowout. Because they're not going to have a blowout because of being predetermined.
Right.
So, you know, you can go to a baseball game that's 20-1. You can go to a football game that's 21-0. You can go to those, and that can be boring.
You can go to a boxing match where Mike Tyson knocks the guy out in the first 20 seconds of the first round.
Yeah, yeah. But this, you are getting a show. You are getting a show. And you don't know who's going to win. It's very unique in that way, because unlike a movie, you can get a spoiler to a movie or have an, and they're playing a different character. These people are not playing characters so much. So that's also interesting. They're not stuntmen. You know, it's a whole, I don't even know how you'd qualify that industry. It's a very, very unique industry.
Yeah, because there is a certain amount of it that is pure entertainment.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and fans recognize that, you know. And like you said, you get criticized for being, well, it's all staged, it's all fake, it's all, you know, it's all those things. But the fans go in knowing that, you know, there's a certain amount of choreography to it. You know, it's entertainment.
But, you know, to a certain degree, I think that's why in a match where there's a crescendo. You know, as you say, if Mike Tyson comes in, let's say, boy, you've been psyched to see this match for months and months and months and months, and he knocks him out in the first run, it's very anticlimactic.
Yeah.
But in a wrestling match, you still don't know who's going to win. You want your guy to win, and they give you that 20-minute show. You go home with everything you expected it to be, and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but you can still say, wow, what a performance.
Right.
What a show.
Yeah.
I got my money's worth.
That's true. That's true.
So I think that's a plus for their business.
Yeah. And maybe that's why it has maintained such popularity.
Well, and I will also say something that I think is very interesting. You know, predetermined, yes, they know when they go out there who's going to win. But that's based on a lot of things. That's not one guy back there going, I think this guy should win, I think this guy should lose. That's based on what's going to be best for business, who's getting big reactions, who's drawing big crowds, who's not drawing big crowds, are crowds starting to wane, are sponsors involved here? You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that that is not predetermined. You can't make a man, you can't say, well, you're going to go out there every Monday night and we're just going to, you're going to start to fill the seats up. Well, that guy isn't going to be the world champion. He isn't going to be the winner, because you want somebody in there who can carry the ball. So it's based on a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So any final thoughts on your trip to Philadelphia and New York?
Well, it certainly was once in a lifetime, I think. And I think, and I said this before, and I do believe it. It's, you know, I was very lucky to get to do it. Most people won't get to do that in their lifetime, so I'm very lucky in that regard. But I believe that it does make the right choices in your life. You've got to be in the right place at the right time with the right people. And I do believe that had I made other choices along the way or been around other people, that it would not have happened. And you, not that it would have been bad, it just wouldn't have happened. And I think you have to be hyper aware of that in the situations and decisions you make in your life.
And
be aware.
I think that's a good point, because it's all those decisions that you make in your life. You know, you're not making decisions planning on this kind of event happening 6 months from now. You know, every decision that you're making is going to have its ramifications the years down the road. I mean, who would have ever known that this is what it would have led to?
Well, you know what? When it comes down to the final stages of it, the two people who were there with me who did help a lot, Carrington and Matt, I didn't have solid relationships with either one of them a year ago.
Right.
So there you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, last week we were all staying in the same hotel room.
Like one big family.
Like one big, I'm not going to say happy, one big family. Like, you know, they were happy with me, but Beyond that, I can't speak to it.
We do have a couple minutes left. So was it predetermined that you were going to fly and they were going to drive?
That was predetermined.
Okay.
But at one point, there were supposed to be more people in the car than just the two of them. So maybe that was where the hitch and that giddy up fell apart, as they say.
Any final thoughts on Monday's event at the
fun
great
fun
eclipse?
Fun. Still waiting for the dollar to come back, and that went off very well, and we had a good time with that eclipse. Good. All the build up to it weird, but it was fun watching that dollar go up.
Which way did the balloons go?
East.
Okay.
East. So
they were headed out over Meyer and
yep.
places to the east
in that direction.
I hope you hear back.
I do too.
Just from the standpoint of where it finally ended up.
Somebody somewhere, even mowing their lawn at some point, is going to have to see these 30 balloons tied to this piece of plastic. And there's even clips on there. I mean, you're not just going to run over that with your lawnmower.
Right.
So it's going to end up, unless it ended up in a river, which is highly unlikely, it's going to be found at some point. Now, it could be laying in somebody's field right now, because nobody certainly has mowed in the last 4 days, which is probably what has happened, right. But I think it will turn up at some point.
Yeah, because, I mean, it could have landed on a pond or a lake, but even then, those are such a small area. I mean, you know, 99% chance of landing on land.
Yeah, yeah, it had to have. And in the road, even. I mean, you know, it's not like a wild animal drug it off. I mean, it'll show back up at some point. Or maybe somebody's even taken it and not realized what the card said, because the card is tucked away behind the dollar. So maybe there's that as well. And I don't think people throw money away. How many times do we walk down the street and find a penny and say, oh, there it is?
Yeah.
And that's what this is.
So somewhere there's a mama raccoon trying to read that card and just saying,
call that number.
I just don't know what this says.
Toll free. They don't want to call a toll line. They want to call the toll free line.
That's a conversation for another day.
It is.
All the things that we have to explain to the younger generation because they
never experienced it. Yeah.
Toll free number.
The toll free line.
All right. Well, thank you, Scott, for hanging around.
Fun.
Yeah, it's fun. It's just nice to just kind of sit and talk. And like I said, you've been on the road last week, and I've been on the road for 3 weeks. And sometimes it's kind of nice to just
lay back.
Yeah. Thank you, folks, for hanging with us. And tonight we have at 8 o'clock, from 8 to 10, is Scott and Matt and Carrington. First time together on the radio since they departed from Steak and Shake. And then afterwards at 10 o'clock, Matt has his show, and he maybe have a guest, maybe not have a guest. I don't know.
We don't know yet.
So you'll want to tune in tonight and catch them. And I will see you next week. I'll be back next Friday. And have a good weekend this weekend. And I will talk to you later. And as Scott would say for his closing,
we're heading for the dugout.
You're listening to The Talking Place from Charlie Evers.
You know, you could come in handy, too, with that electricity. If we have problems with our transmitter, which is above you, yeah, all you'd have to do is raise your hands and energize our transmitter.
To formerly of WNCI, Weasel Boy, is that true? I've never asked that question on air before, by the way, but...
I can tell with it.
I wasn't even sure how to word it.
When the way your arms got going, I figured.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you've
yeah.
never asked anybody that question.
I wouldn't even know. To 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow. Do you think he needed her after that primary election?
Yes, and I think I go back to Abraham Lincoln.